Name, are you from Torah Shraka?
Yeah, yeah.
You are, what?
Binyamin Siegel.
Binyamin Siegel, wow. You're a Gesunter guy. I'm going to take you with me and I got to walk through a dangerous place. I am so happy to see everybody. I have no idea. I'm lucky to get back. It was a real struggle with the snow. I'm so happy to be here. Anyway, there's so much I want to do, and let me begin. Today is Sunday, the 16th of January, 2011. And I say, Beruchim HaNimtzayim to all my students sitting in front of me. And I say fondly to all those across the world listening, if I'm to believe all the people I met that claim they're my students, I am the biggest Rebbe in the world. And I can tell you, in Flatbush, the assistant rabbi of the shul started, he says he knows 200 of my shirim backwards and forwards, and he starts saying over to me, I couldn't believe what I'm hearing. I forgot already what I said, and he was right on. Now, everyone asked me about the trip, so I'm going to tell you two stories that I think illustrate my 3.5 weeks that I was gone. And it'll come back in certainly in tomorrow's class, in next week's Monday class. But one story is great, and one story is our difficulty, the good and the struggle, we'll put it that way. You follow me, Eitan? I don't want to say the good and the bad, because life, people have questions, people trouble you, people are seeking, questing, searching. The good story is beautiful, very moving to me, particularly after this Friday night. I was in Las Vegas, as you know, and I was the guest of the shul, and there were a lot of fascinating people there, people seeking and searching, and very impressive dedication to Yiddishkeit. There was some Afro-American women sitting at the Rabbi Shabbos table, which only had 35, 40 people, and I see them singing Zmiras and such Kavanah. I said, who are they? And he told me these are, one of them was converting the next day, these African-American women who are very successful and work and not getting married, nothing to do with the man, converting for the sake of love of Yiddishkeit. But the story I wanted to tell you is one of the key women in the community, she and her husband, and I'm their guest a number of times, and basically they were the ones, he's my Talmud, and via the website, and he had contacted me over a year ago. I don't remember if I could come to Las Vegas and give some shiurim. And for whatever the reasons are, they've never been to Israel. It's not simply lack of time. They have children, and they both have, you know, both have businesses that they run. So they've never been to Israel. So sitting in their home, I just want to show, I have a very special watch that very few can match. Israel, America, and the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, hand in hand, given to me by a Talmud who was born in the... When you were born, was the former Soviet Union or was still the Soviet Union? The former already. So I want you to know I appreciate this watch. It's special to me. So they've never been to Israel. So I'm describing to this woman, who's a Balat Shuva. These people were not born in Yiddishkeit and were not raised in Yiddishkeit, but seeking, searching, and have been from for many years already. And I'm describing Friday night at the Kotel, the davening, the thousands that are there, and she starts to cry. And I say to her, well, what would you do if you came Friday night and you would daven with us at the Kotel? I told her, I have a minyan there, 42 years. She says, I would never leave. And I was so moved, both by the tears, I don't have to tell you, I cry too. I cry easily, but it's for good reason. I saw the Holocaust. You don't start to understand me. I lived in America, I'm a third generation, but I was totally surrounded by all my friends in yeshiva were either survivors or kids who had come to America in the late 30s whose parents, you know, they're not good at Yiddish. And I was like an American kid. I stood out. Then I saw the Shanghai crowd. So, thank God. Wonderful people. It was very moving for me. So I went to the Kotel Friday night. And, you know, they frighten you, rain and rain and rain. So I took rain pants with me, and I took rubbers, and I have to say, one student comes to the Kotel to walk me home, he won't let me carry anything, he carried home my bag, what I have in it, rain pants and rubbers. You know, so anyway, it didn't rain. Do you know what a crowd there was at the Kotel this Friday night? I mean, what would you say, Nachum? Over 10,000? Did you see the whole area in front and the area in back? And the group from the army, hundreds, and taglit, how do you say, birthright, and a whole French group of birthright, and goyish tourists. Wow. And I kept on thinking of that wonderful lady in Las Vegas with such a beautiful soul. I saw such elegkeit. So that's one story. Now let's go to the end of the trip from Las Vegas, and I saw Hollywood, Florida, Bal Harbour, Florida, Hillcrest, Queens, and finally four events in Flatbush. And here I am, Shabbos morning in Flatbush, and it didn't snow. They also said snow, it just flurries. Tremendous crowd. This is a shul that was once one of the main modern Orthodox shuls, Kingsway Jewish Sentence on King's Highway. They call it Kingsway. I remember the founding rabbi, if not the first rabbi, Rabbi Samuel Chills, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, an American who went to Mir to learn in the 30s. Oh, what a shul. Today, the shtibbles are all over the place. And who wants to, you know, the new generation, they see a machitza with lattice where the women can see a little bit through. Who wants to daven there? I went to a shtibbel Sunday morning, my Talmud took me where he davened Sunday morning. The women are in a different room altogether, no machitza, no nothing, a totally separate room. So, you know, the shtiblach and are putting these shuls out of business. But anyway, I'm speaking, and there were tremendous crowds, hundreds and hundreds came. Obviously not all from the shul, from the surrounding area. So I give this talk, the two talks, Friday night and Shabbos morning, were connected. The third and fourth talk were different, but they were connected, and it's the talks they want. And it was on basically the religious reality. Friday night was Israel, Shabbos morning was America. So in my talk, I touch upon the challenges, again, using all my Divrei Torah, Gerbet Toshav, all the Rav's Divrei Torah, who the heck am I to say my Divrei Torah, all my Rebbe's Divrei Torah, the Gerbet Toshav, yeah, it's powerful material. And I come down to the challenge of feminism, and I have my line that everyone's quoting, everyone loves it, you saw Rabbi Willick, Rabbi Mordechai Willick, who was dancing around me the other morning, the day he was leaving is the day I came home, right, Thursday morning. So we met here, I told him my vat, that a woman can be a Hasidic Rebbe, but she can't be a rabbi. And you heard me in class. And we all agree, Rebbe Chin Kanyevsky, if you've seen the weekend papers, she's the biggest Hasidic Rebbe in the world today. Rebbe Chin Kanyevsky, that's Rabbi Yashim's daughter. It's the Rebbe Chaim Kanyevsky's wife. She's a granddaughter of Rabbi Levine. I mean, no one has more yichus than she has. She's a great niece to the Chazon Mish. Come on, what are we talking about? So, a great niece or a niece to the Chazon Ish, I should say. So, and I explained, but a practicing rabbi, we just can't change the halacha. And even though, according to the New York Times, men and women are equal, and this concept that women can't testify, can't be part of a Beit Din, Lekiyum Dava, etc., etc., the New York Times doesn't understand it. And maybe we don't. I say we're influenced by the New York Times. But when it comes to Torah, I have to say, I'm a giver. I have to surrender. All right, fine, beautiful, good. Finish the talk. So let's say there were 400 people there, 395, beautiful, Yashikaya, whatever. Five people wanted to kill me. Their daughter got married, and the rabbah had a bracha under the chuppah. And you mean to tell me that is not Torah? So let me tell you, and you know, my comment said, Rebbe, what are you so upset? 395 people loved you. Five people were a little upset, the rabbah business. What? I said, no, I'm upset because it hurts me to see wherever I was in America, the rabbahs, the rabbah, you understand? Believe me, Sarah Hirsch, I see Ephraim, you know what we're talking about. Avi Weiss ordained the woman. And at first he gave her the title Maharat, if I'm quoting it correctly. I don't have time now to go into it. Last year I gave a whole shiur. And he now she's the Rabbah. You follow me? You're a rab. She's a rabba. You don't know what's going on in America? No wonder you're going to live long. Keep yourself ignorant. You'll be okay. Got it? Okay. Now, to all the people listening across the world, there were so many emails waiting for me, I apologize that I can't answer each one individually. But I want to take out 5 minutes now and just answer, because it has to do with Shurim I gave. Number one, with Rav Aaron Cutler and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, my contact in America, who's really a fabulous person and knows a great deal, and he's a Lubavitcher and he's my Talmud, and he's a wonderful individual. So I have to agree with him. He says that what making of a gadol, what Rav Kalinowski says, putting the machloket back to the 1930s is not correct. I know when I learned in Lakewood, they did say that there was this explosion over Parsha Nagach et HaParah. But my contact claims, and this I happen to know is true, and I don't want to go into more detail now, the tension between Chabad and Reb Aaron Cutler, and he was the leading personality in the Litvisher world, was exacerbated by the Vat Hatzalah. And here you come to the terrible, terrible truth. When you're involved in Hatzalah, you always have to make choices. And I can tell you, when I came out of Russia the first time in 1981, so Malk and I were going crazy. What can we do? How can we save these Jews? You know what it's like to see Jews behind the Iron Curtain who want to be Shomer Shabbos, want to be Makbid in Kashrut, and they're afraid of being thrown into the gulag. They can't study Torah. They can't make a bar mitzvah for their children. According to communist law, teaching a child religion under 18 is religious indoctrination is forbidden. In other words, to teach a child atheism is okay, because that's the communist viewpoint. What did Marx and Engels say? Two good Jews. God is man and man is God. Don't forget that statement. You understand what that statement means? God is man and man is God. It means there's no God, just man. You do what you want. You can kill as many as you want, shoot as many as you want. There is no divine law. So, you know how much it hurt to see these people suffering. So we made a decision to work for the Essos family to get them out. And I'll come back to this in the Monday class. It's not for now. We succeeded. I have the signature of the Mossad on the fact that we succeeded against all odds. Okay. My good friend, who's not well for many years, Rabbi Dr. Professor Tzvi Groner, check out who he was in his prime, says to me, who gave you the right to choose one family? Why don't you work for this one, that one, the other one? And I said, Tzvi, if I work for 3 million Jews behind the Iron Curtain, I accomplished nothing. If I work for one, maybe I'll accomplish. And this has to do with Hatzalah work. And the tensions in the Vat Hatzalah exacerbated, if I'm using the right word and pronouncing it correctly, I know it's the right word, just tell me if my pronunciation is correct. It made the tension so much more intense. And when you had to choose, Reb Aaron chose the Litvak, and the Lubavitchers wanted the Lubavitcher, the Chassidish guy. And the machloket was real, but not as profound as Reb Nesson Kamenetsky would make it out to be. And I will accept, it's not a correction, it's just a clarification of all that happened, because I know this material, I lived it, I know it inside out. Now, the story I mentioned about Zmanei Tfilah, many times I've come to the problem with the Satmar Rebbe being Mezalzel in Zmanei Tfilah. And I told you the story, I heard from my witnesses, my childhood friend whom I grew up with, my friend for life, the great Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Abba Brandspiegel. Okay, make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise, but he was one of the leading Rebbeim in YU who left to go to Lander College. He's the Rosh Yeshiva there today. So Rav Abba, when he came to America, he survived with miracles, came to America on the boat from Switzerland. He was on the boat with the Satmar Rebbe. And he told me stories of the Rebbe. He would daven at 2 o'clock in the afternoon if it starts Shacharis, 1 o'clock, etc., etc. One time the Rebbe saw chassidim, young kids, younger than you, and they started davening late. The Rebbe said, "How are you davening shachris so late?" So they said to the Rebbe, "Rebbe, min tut vi de Rebbe tut. We're emulating the Rebbe." The Rebbe said, "My father davened late. Your father davened on time." So a Simon Wanderer, I acknowledged this from Manchester, if I'm not mistaken, sent me a beautiful long email, and he tells me, he gives me a quote, he sends a sefer here, Iyunei Halachot, from Tzvi Rabinovitz, that the Satma wouldn't come to a Brit. They posted the time of davening is 11 o'clock, so the Rebbe could come and be the Sunday. It was for a great nephew, I believe. So the Rebbe was furious that they said 11 o'clock davening. So the Rebbe said, they said to the Rebbe, "But Rebbe, you stopped davening shachris at 11 o'clock. Why are you so upset? Because you have to call davening for 8 o'clock. Normal people, it happens, it takes me longer to get ready to daven. But a klal hora for everybody, that it cannot be." Now, the question of Shmirat Shabbos and public and the public thoroughfare, where Simon Wanderer says, "I differ with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein," yeah, there may be truth that we differ on that. But I think, I'll tell you what the test case is. To say it in a minute, Rabbi Aaron has always said, following the Rebbe's viewpoint, that we don't need religious legislation. That religious legislation pushes people away from Yiddishkeit. I have often said, who am I to differ with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein? But on this issue I hold, the public thoroughfare in Israel has to be a Jewish, a Torah public thoroughfare. If not, we have no claim to the land. Who are we? What makes us Jews? And the test case is buses running on Shabbos. I'm not certain Rabbi Aaron would disagree with me. I consider it extremely important that there be no public transportation on Shabbos. Halavai, we can shut the airport down on Shabbos like it's done on Yom Kippur, because that's what makes a Jewish state. And people have to know that this is a Jewish state. Every kitchen has to be kosher. And thank God we run an army that's kosher, an army that's Shomer Shabbos. So if you don't have the public thoroughfare, what's our claim to the land? Our claim is that we're continuity of the Jewish people, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and all the generations, and Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni. What connects us? Not only the DNA, but the way we live. Now, I'm not in favor of going into anyone's house and checking, is he kosher, not kosher? And this, of course, is the constant ongoing question, a Jewish state, a democratic state. I've heard students of Rabbi Dr. Professor David Hartman come out with big lectures in favor of buses running on Shabbos. I totally, completely disagree. I don't believe Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein would come down on their side. I think he would come down on my side. But it's an interesting comment, and I accept it. Now, he also writes to me about boys and girls in the Hirshian school. So he writes a story. His mother, my grandmother, attended the Rabbi Centerfold here, Shula, and told me she was reprimanded for walking home with a boy by the headmaster of the school, who told her it was not appropriate. Given her age, I would estimate this was around 1930. That's an interesting comment. I can only tell you, my daughters went to Hirshian, to Horeg here, where it had the boys' school and the girls' school. I think they're still on in Katamon. They're right next to each other. And I don't ever remember anyone reprimanding them for walking home and talking to a boy who was their neighbor. But be it as it may, by 1930, if you've heard my lectures on German Orthodoxy, there was tremendous input of what you call the move to the right after World War I, after they met the Polish Hasidim and the Litvishi Yidden. So it could be, and it's not contradictory. Finally, where I didn't realize I was stepping into such lumdis that my Talmud, Dr. Alan Blau, and my Talmud, Rabbi Yoshua Grinstein. So I mentioned in passing, we got involved with the making of a gadol, with the whole question of shaving. But as a sideshow, I mentioned the whole with the mir yeshiva, with the tzitzit, not kissing the tzitzit. So I have to state again, when I was growing up, I was taught it is a primitive act. It was brisk, it was litvish. It was Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik. We, you all heard the stories that Rabbi Reuben told you when Chaim Nashman, today he pronounces his name Nyman, but I knew him as Nashman. When Chaim Nashman, who was a chaver of Nachum's father, Abraham Lamb, when he kissed the mezuzah, Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik went berserk, to put it mildly. That's what I was taught. Reb Nathan Kamenetsky comes up already with tremendous mir, musa, gadlet adam. You have to, again, have heard my lectures on Slabatka, on the out of Slabatka. And the Alta was furious. How do you take out an underwear garment and show it in public? It's a disgrace. You don't kiss it, sit, sit. So my students write to me. First of all, it's based upon a... They come up with a tour, they come up from the Rishonim, that you have two tzitzis in back, two tzitzis in front, someone who kissed the two tzitzis in front, all the makarot. I don't agree entirely, because I think that's only telling you how you wear the avakampus, but it doesn't mean you can't take the tzitzis in back and pull it in front for a few minutes. Some say the Gaon didn't say the tzitzis, they give me a source that I want to check out in the Maaser Rav. Some say he only kissed two tzitzis in front. The best story I heard is that Rabbi Sohn told me that Rabbi Lichtenstein dabbled in some shtibble in Borough Park, and this fellow had a relative there who was a Chassidish Yid, and he said to him, "Nu, you saw Rabbi Lichtenstein. What, did you realize what a gadol?" The guy says, "He didn't kiss his tzitzit. I can't look at Jews that don't kiss their tzitzit. You understand?" So this is ongoing. All I can tell you is I told my own grandchildren, don't do like your grandfather. I saw the rub, it's one thing. You fellas, you were raised in a different world, you can kiss your tzitzit. But I thank those who sent in and they added so many sources. If I were to give a shiur on the tzitzit kissing, I have a lot of sources today. Finally, one correction. From the Summum Rosh, I translated the Kochav Nogah as the North Star. Two people corrected me. It's Venus. Now, what is it? The North Star or Venus?
Kochav is Mercury, Nogah is Venus.
Nogah is Venus. Anyway, he writes Kochav Nogah, and I translated the North Star. I don't know where I got that translation. It's not my own. I tried to find out where I got it. I was not successful, but I accept the correction most graciously. Now, into the Summum Rosh, and a world of material yet awaits us. Again, last week we dealt with the tremendous problem of Jewish philosophy in the Summum Rosh, and the chutzpah to put it into the Rosh who was so opposed to the study of Jewish philosophy. Nevertheless, he challenges the Rambam on the Ikarim, and Ephraim was very upset. How can you challenge the Rambam on the Ikarim? So I, Ephraim, again, I want to state to you, it doesn't mean he necessarily didn't believe in the Ikarim. It means, how do you make it into Ikarim? In other words, if someone tells you he believes that God has a corporeal form, like the Ravid, like the Rabbad, you're going to call him an Apikoros? You understand? Now, I saw in Divrei HaRav that just came out, how many of you have the Divrei HaRav of Heschel Schechter's third work on the Rav? So he reproduces in this volume, there is some very, very valuable material. It's drasha that the Rav gave years ago that were published in Hapardes, and Rav Heschel reproduces them. Now, I have the original from Hapardes. I gained the least out of it, but I'm telling people it's fabulous. There's one famous drasha there the Rav gave in 1943 dealing with Kiddush HaChodesh. So, first of all, you'll see there that the Rav takes halachic gemaras and he gives it hashkafic, philosophic, Hasidic interpretations, just like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But that's not number two. On page 20, he shows you a viewpoint of the Rambam in relation to piyut and philosophical prayers about God, and how we don't follow the Rambam's viewpoint. And you'll see there, where you see the Rav quoting that Klal Yisrael, I don't want to say abrogated the Rambam's viewpoint, and that's what the Summum Rosh is trying to say. To turn it into Ikarim, that far you can't go. And finally, the Summum Rosh ends off, he goes back and forth and back and forth, And he ends off that maybe Bizman Hazeh we need Ikarim that people have to know. We can understand the Rambam. It's a breakdown in faith. But what's important about the Tshuva, you hear the echo of Moses Mendelssohn, creed or deed. It is the battle with coming out of the ghetto and being challenged by universal, or what I'll call in modern terminology, Western religion. If I can come back to what I started this year with at 5:30, when I spoke with some of these Afro-American women, what brought you to Judaism? And they told me they wanted a religion that was full-time. I heard those exact words. I have a student from Midrashit Moriah from Boston, from Maimonides. She married an Afro-American genius who converted when he was 17, 18. He's a Talmud of my son-in-law. Converted ages before he met her. And a brilliant fellow. His parents are both professors and he has at least two doctorates. So I asked him, what made you convert at the age of 17? He said, look, I went to church once a week. My parents are believers. The whole religion lasted 1 hour a week. He said, I wanted more. I researched all the religions and that are available in America. You know, he didn't, I don't know what he did, you know, with the place in China, but in America. And he said, I reached the conclusion, the only religion that is 24/7 is Torah Hashem Tamima. That's exactly what these ladies told me. So you have to understand that there is something in this debate, creed or deed. And I wouldn't dismiss Mendelssohn. You know, people don't realize it's not that he didn't believe, but the Ika, the part of the scale that fell was the deed. This is Judaism. And then as I told you, I live with it, I believe it, and I've told many students who come to problems, Balei Tshuva, people who were raised in Yiddishkeit and want to throw it away, you talk with them. And I've often felt that when you observe, your questions are answered. That's the Uri Zohar story I told you. I don't think any story says it better than the Uri Zohar story. Okay, so that's the Tshuva. And look into the Divrei HaRav. Who has it? Who can show it to Ephraim? Gentlemen, you don't buy Rav Heschel Schechter publishes a new sefer and it's sold here cut rate. Oh my gosh, my book will come out. Who's going to buy it? Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go to outer space to sell it.
Where is it being sold?
It was sold in the Beis Medrash. Why? Well, there's a student there, Isaac. What's his name? Isaac Rice, right?
Rice.
He was selling it. He's evidently a Talmud Mubarak Rav Heschel. He helped him prepare it. So ask him to show it to you. Page 20. You'll see what I'm talking about. And you'll ask the same question. How do you dismiss the Rambam? It's not that you dismiss. But you don't have to hold like that Rambam. It's his point of view there, which is philosophical. You'll see Klal Yisrael sort of abrogated it. Yes.
Two questions.
Mental, yeah.
So what is, if you'll correct me, when the Raggad argues with Rambam,
That's what people amalamed schud on the right, because our minds can't comprehend the corporeal God. You understand? We have been so raised on the Rambam, and our whole way of thinking is so much against the corporeal form. You're hitting the nail exactly on the head. But he says you can't call a person an apikoros. If that's the way he understands God, because he's limited, he's a human being. Divra Torah Balashim B'nai Adam. Not an apikoros. Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. I can tell you, in my life, I had a terrible experience that shattered me. I could never understand Aveda Zara. Here I'm learning in Yeshiva, Aveda Zara, and you know, I learned Sanhedrin with the Rav. Who doesn't? Today I've gone through Masechet Aveda Zara twice already, and doing, you know, learning through Shas. But one time I'm engaged to my wife-to-be, and Sunday morning in those years, it must have been 59, I graduated college, there's no kollel, you have to earn a living. So I was teaching Sunday school. I was teaching Talmud Torah, not just Sunday school. Studying for Smicha, and teaching, I think, two afternoons a week and Sunday morning. So I'm going to see my wife-to-be after I finish teaching. She lived in a part of the Bronx, was a fancy neighborhood at the time, Bainbridge Avenue near Gunhill Road, a very Catholic neighborhood. And there's this, this tremendous church. And in front of the church is a getchka. And I'm walking, and this woman is wheeling a baby carriage, a young woman, an Italian woman, a nice woman. I mean, you know, nothing against the chasva chalila. And this kid of 3 years old or 2 years old from the baby carriage says, "Mama, what's that?" And she points to the statue. The kid points to the statue. The mother answers, "That's God." And I'm walking behind. I was shaking. I was shivering. So you see, we can't. But the Ravid says, in theory, if he wants to believe that God and the Eish coming out of his nostrils, we say as if to speak, we don't call him an apikoros. Yeah. What's the other question?
In terms of with the Piyutim, there are posts in the Quran who also oppose it. Not like I think Rav Chaim Volozhin said it.
And I'll be saying, when it comes to the Piyutim, there are those who say everything and those who say nothing. But I have to tell you, with the Rav, he did like the Vilna Gaon, that he didn't say. But where he did say, he said everything. And he held Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you're not Yotzei, that mamish, you miss out on davening if you don't say the Piyutim. That it's mamish, it creates the Kedushat Hayom, it creates the feeling of the day, the emotion of the day. But listen, you have to be attuned to it. Again, I had a Rebbe, Reb Henoch Fishman, from the Shanghai crowd. So Henoch, I was very close to him. It was a Ben Bayit in his house. I took his son, Rebbe, my son died years ago, but left something like 10, 11 children. There must be hundreds and hundreds of descendants from Heshi, his son. Heshi was a YU boy afterwards. Reb Henoch was very with it. And so I was very close to Reb Henoch. I took Heshi to his first baseball game, you understand? I Americanized him. So Reb Henoch once said to me, in a moment of truth, he let his hair down. I was too young to appreciate at the time. He said, "You know, I regret that in Mir, when everyone was singing Lecha Dodi, I was learning Gemara." You follow? So you know, you have to have a feeling. What's wrong with a Jew who doesn't say Kabbalah Shabbos? Where does it say you have to say Kabbalah Shabbos? Where does it say you have to sing Lecha Dodi? But I tell you that Shabbos would not be Shabbos without Lecha Dodi. It's the last addition to the Siddur that was universally accepted by all Jews. I want to move on. I gotta.
So if the Rav understood halachic gemaras allegorically, how come?
In addition, in other words, the halacha is the halacha, but his dashanut went beyond the times, and he took Kiddush HaChodesh and what he did with Kiddush HaChodesh. And the fact that you need a minion in Eretz Yisrael, and this is God's promise that there will always be a minion of Jews looking to the Rambam Sefer Mitzvah. I think it's Kuf Nun Gimel, if I'm not making a mistake, Mitzvah Aseh. And he dashed, this is the history of the Jewish people, and he saw it in such a beautiful homiletic sense. So a Chabatnik can say, "No, if the Rav can do that, why can't the Rebbe?" I'm sure the Rebbe didn't mean Shoshanaga Chatapara means the Yetzirah being knocked over by the Yetzirah. You understand? But once you have the basic shot, Shivim Panim LaTorah. And Rav Aaron Kotler evidently held Chas V'Chalila, Shivim Panim LaTorah is on non-halachic aspects. But halacha is halacha. And how dare you come and take a Gemara and learn into it all of Tanya. Okay? All right. Now, today, I want to pick up with something very, very important. We started it last time, and I pick it up now, the B'Samer Rosh Lamech. And I'm going to show you contemporary influence. Am I reading too much into it? I don't know. Again, I raised the problem we raised weeks ago and months ago, and I admit it is a problem. But again, just to refurbish your memories, al pi halacha, a niece can marry her uncle. A nephew cannot marry his aunt. That is the halacha. The Rav used to teach us. Remember the Rav banged, if you hear it, it's on a tape, by the way, a very famous tape of one of the Rav's talk in the early 70s at the RCA when he did Pashat Chukah. He bang three times. Why am I banging? The banging represents acceptance. But then, we're only human beings. Why? Why is this? If a niece can marry her uncle, why can't a nephew marry his aunt? So I can tell you what generally is said. Part of it you say publicly, part of it you don't want to say publicly. The part that you say publicly is very simple. Many times there's an uncle who never made it, never married. The niece has mercy on him and marries him and gives him a wife, perhaps a family, etc. Again, you all know the classic example is Nechama Leibovich. Say, Zichronet Tzadeket Levracha. She married her uncle, but if she told me many times, the world makes a mistake. Olamos Tzadkut, Choshvim Shechatanti Rak Mitzad Harachamim Chas V'Chalila Sipur Ahava. And if you read the biography of her, I read the Hebrew one, Chayut the Deutsch. I've not read the English one, which I'm told is also good, by Unterman. But I read the Hebrew one, you'll understand her coming to Rakethet a million times better. It seems she didn't only say it to me, she said it to many people, and it explains why there was this love between her and her uncle, because basically her uncle was the only one who understood her. And it's a fascinating biography, a fascinating woman, the greatest Torah scholar of the 20th century, and she was not a feminist. It's a fascinating biography, and it's, if you knew Nechama as well as I did, I can tell you, I sign on the dotted line. Now, when you look and say, well, if that's the case, why can't a nephew marry his aunt? Because a man, unfortunately, the hormones are much more powerful. And I don't have to tell you, you're living in the state of Israel, you don't know how disgraceful the president of Israel being found guilty of rape. I underlined the word rape. It's frightening. And wherever I went in America, you understand, it's frightening. There's nothing. I don't have to tell you the crimes in the Torah world. People who supposedly should be B'nai Torah and live with Shabbat and Kashrut and Tarat Mishpacha, underline the words Tarat Mishpacha, you all know the scandals we have had in all elements in the greater Torah world. Okay. So you can imagine already, if you permit a nephew to marry his aunt, who knows what kind of hanky-panky there'll be between the nephews and beautiful aunts. So there's something to it. Even logically, you don't have to say, I accept it. Even logically, you can make a very strong case. Now, the case in the Besom and Rosh is a classic case where a nephew marries his aunt. This woman was living with this young man's uncle. And afterwards, the nephew married her. And here you come into the whole case. Is there a nisa here? Well, if she was an eshet ish, there absolutely is a prohibition. But what about if she was not an eshet ish, just a pilegesh? Is there a prohibition? And the Gemara is quite clear that if it's not sanctified by chuppah v'kedushin, there's no prohibition. Anusat aviv, anusat his uncle, the uncle seduced the woman, you can marry her. If the uncle lives with a woman and there's no kedushin, so it's an ongoing seduction. But there is no prohibition. And in this case, they asked if there are any witnesses, was there a marriage? And no witnesses came forth. And afterwards, he married her. And there was a tremendous outcry.
Is that now, true of an aunt?
Excuse me?
Is it true of a father as well? The father is living with the woman and then can the son marry
her? There may be an Issa the Rabbanim. If I recall the Gemara, there may be an Issa the Rabbanim. It has to be checked out,
But with this case, the nephew and the aunt, it would be mutter. If it brings it down, of course, that's exactly with Avshalom. But people were yelling. It's something that's shocking. Something, you take a look, the nephew's married to the woman who was living with his uncle. It's shocking. Now, you know what's amazing about this question? This is actually basically copied the question almost word by word from Tshuvat HaRash. And here, I quote to you from the Tshuvat HaRash, Klal Shloshim Vishnayim, subdivision 1. That's the way the Tshuvat HaRash is divided. Klal, I don't know how to translate that, probably called it Master Chapter 33, subdivision 1. And exactly the same question, V'achakach Nasa Shmuel Ben Shimon, Achid Uvein, Otah HaPilegish, Al Yedei Chupa V'Kedushin, Va'ata Yesh Odin In Alev, Shelo K'din Nasa, Al Kein Yoreinu Adoneinu K'dat Ma La'asot B'davah Hazer. And they turn to the Rush. What is the halacha? And he says, this is the Rush now, not the B'samim Rosh, I'm quoting from. Dafka kishaita eshet achi aviv b'kedushin, the mikre yishut. Avo pilegesh achi aviv muteret lo. And he says, this lady, there was no eidet of kedushin. And therefore it's like the Gemara says, mutar. But Anusat Aviv, here's the answer, that even the Anusat Aviv, Umufutat Aviv, is Mutter, Me'ika Hadin. V'chein Achitefa L'mal Avshalom, Sheyavo Al Pilegish Aviv. Okay? So you see, it's Mutter, Allah Hatama V'kama. If Avshalom can live with the Pilegish of his father, then the nephew can live with the aunt who was a pilegish of his uncle. But if there'll be witnesses that heard the woman say that he married me in front of two witnesses, it's not no longer a pilegish, it is an eshedish, and he had no right to marry her. And this is Na'um Asher ben Harab Yechiel. Now, notice something else, and I called your attention to this about 20 years ago in my early lectures in this course, that the Tshuvot of the Rishonim are very brief. You see, here there's a tremendous question, and it's answered in one paragraph by the Rush. You take a look at the Besomim Rosh, and you see a much longer answer. And he gets involved here with an insight that may be totally contemporary and a reflection of leaving the ghetto and all that happened. And this is an insight that has halachic implications for hundreds of thousands of Jews throughout the world. It may even reach the number of millions, without exaggeration. What am I talking about? So what do you mean, Pilegish? What are we talking about, Pilegish? They're living together. She's going to mikvah. What creates a marriage? But you see, in the world before modernity, men and women lived together. They were married. There was occasionally a sinner. You see it in the response literature. But that sinner was batil b'miyot. It was nullified. It was a miyot shein nika. You come into the modern world, all standards are broken down. Today it's taken for granted that a boy and a girl start sleeping together at the age of 18. God have mercy. We're going to have a royal wedding in England. Don't want to comment on it. How many years are they living together already? It's machlekes ha-poskim. 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, fine. Three different viewpoints. But the world doesn't say, boo. This is normal. It's a totally antithesis approach to Torah. To us, sex. A woman came over to me in Flatbush, a number of women, but this woman said to me, Rebbe, I remember one thing you said at Hebrew University in 1970. You gave a lecture on feminism, and she quoted a line that I said, you're absolutely right, you're maskiranish kachad. I said, feminists should be finding that a woman should be a subject, not an object. You understand what I'm saying? Tarat mishpacha turns a woman into a subject. Love, marriage, chuppah, kedushin, a woman's a subject. In the big Western world today, in Clinton's world, in Kassab's world, in the New York Times world, a woman is an object. She has a right to say no. I'm quoting Maureen Dowd now, up that page, which I'll never forget, in the New York Times on Bill Clinton. But she's no longer a subject. The whole Jewish concept has been eradicated in the modern world. Now, let's translate that into halachic terminology. Pilegesh, Pilakshim, the Upper West Side. David Miller's first cousin, Ari Goldman, published the volume, The Search for God at Harvard, Mashu Kazet, you can check the exact title. Yeshiva College graduate, so-called Shomer Shabbos. He describes the West Side scene. Boys and girls sleeping together. God have mercy. My grandson, one of my grandsons, spent the Shabbos on the West Side this past summer. He came back shattered by what he saw in the greater YU crowd. What he saw with kids who studied here in Hakotel, in Shalavim, in KBY. Chas v'chalila, it's not the majority. But unbelievable. Nope. Guy on the Upper West Side, a graduate of Yeshiva College, in his early 30s, meets this Stern College graduate. They're both professionals. I don't want to go into more detail. They're living together in one apartment for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, the relationship breaks up. There's no sanctity, there are no children, there's no commitment, there's no marriage, etc. She goes elsewhere, he goes elsewhere. She turns 30. Miraculously, she meets a Baal Tshuva who studies, got smicha. They get married, chuppah v'kedushin. Tell me, does she need a gift from her first husband? Is she an Esh Hadish? They live together for 2 years. One apartment. You don't need Eidim anymore. I can't give a whole shiur on this now. But the Gemara says, Hein Hein Eidi Bia, Hein Hein Eidi Yuchid, Hein Hein Eidi Bia. There's a chazak already, 30 days, 2 years. Do you realize the implications if this lady would need a get? Hani Mamzerim we would have in the world? Do you understand the implications? How many people, lo aleinu, in this atmosphere, in this climate, in this world? And it's not just people who are Mechalalei Shabbos. I'm not even talking about them. I'm talking about people who are Kleimish, if I can use a Yiddish word. How do you say that? Supposedly, Shomrei Shabbos.
The phrase is 612.
Say the 612. So Zayin Zayin. But do you realize the implications? So what do we say? What do we say? And here, the Summon Rosh says it. This is why. Is it a reflection of modernity? They're out of the ghetto. Out of the ghetto, one of the first big changes in life is marriage is now an affair that the state leaves. You get married, don't get married. There's freedom of religion. You want to get married, the state records it. You don't want to get married, do what you want. No one is going to be burned at the stake by having relations with a lady without chuppah v'kedushin. It's a different world already. So the saving grace that all the poskim say is, in order to get married, ein adam aseh bilato bilat snut, which is the tremendous chazakah of Chazal, which got involved in such battle between Rabbi Rachman and Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. This concept that you don't treat your sexual life as what would be the word, as something cheap, as something promiscuous, that would be a better translation, promiscuous. Doesn't apply today. Today they live together, it's a bilegesh. No, you're not married, who cares? Do you want to be married? No, we're happy like this. We're satisfied. There's no kavana for marriage. There's no intention. It's not more than a pilegish, than a concubine. And this is the saving grace. So that if a girl comes, and I've been through life, gentlemen, my dear students, I've been through life. Although I have to say, in this trip I met problems I never saw before, so you think you've seen it all, you still haven't seen it all. You brace yourself for the rabbinate. But a girl, I have gotten calls from women that not identifying themselves. I can't even repeat what they were telling me. But anyway, so a girl will come to me and say, Rebbe, you know, I was a naughty girl. I what could I do? I was caught up in the West Side. I had relations with this man for 2 years. I was a concubine. I was a pilegish. They'll use the word pilegish, not concubine, because concubine is English. It hurts them more. But a pilegish, you know, it's like when I came in Aliyah, I heard my sister-in-law call my brother-in-law a chamar. I thought that was so quaint, called him a chamar. Someone calls you a jackass, you get upset. Someone calls you a chamar, it's quaint. So she said, you know, she'll say, Rebbe, I was a pilegish for 2 years. I met this Baal Tshuva. He wants to marry me. He also has a spotty past. He was married to a Gentile woman. Everything happened. But today he's really from Mazel Tov. You see, this saves us. We say there's no marriage here. If there's no marriage, there's no man sacred. You need intention for marriage. A pilegish does not a marriage make. Now, you know what's amazing? That's exactly what the Besamim Rosh says. What all the Achronim, now this problem comes up a million times more, Josh, you know where? Civil marriage. You come out of the ghetto, you have civil marriage, you have a choice. Civil marriage, that's a lot more than a pilegish. Civil marriage, generally speaking, the lady takes on the name of the man. Generally speaking, they have a joint bank account. Generally speaking, they have, well, today, you know, you talk about a joint telephone. I better not say a word after what I just saw upstairs, Rabbi Hecky Lookstein waving to me. Oh, there's Rabbi Rakefet. How'd you get back? You got back? Yeah, I got back. Baruch Hashem, the last plane out. I can't believe what goes on in this world. It's unbelievable. Wow. David, you got to watch your P's and Q's. Kol ma'asecha b'seifa nichtavim. Believe me, my rebellion tried to scare us. We left them off. What to say? Today, a video is made as you speak. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's recording. The angels are up there. You appear. You try to double talk. 1 second later, there you are, playing your life out in front of the heavenly court, as if to speak. Let me say it that way, Mendel, so I don't get into trouble with the Ravid or the Rambam. As if to speak. Gentlemen, civil marriage. They have one bank account, one telephone. Everything is in their names. So she doesn't go to mikvah. So they didn't have a rabbi. Who the heck needs a rabbi? You don't read the New York Times, Rebbeinu Shlomo. You don't read Haaretz here. It's amazing what they can say. You're not familiar with Engels and Marx? You know what I just quoted before? It's fabulous. Man is God. God is man. Oh, you're your own boss. You don't have any code to look up to. No one can tell you what to do. You're your own ethics, your own morals. No civil marriage? Do you understand with the Russian immigration how many shyness of zayrit we would have? You don't know what went on in Russia. I know. In America, any boy and girl can go to an extra bedroom. Your parents don't like it. You go to a motel. Russia? There's no way. Family shared apartments. The communist empire gave you a room. I saw Jews refusing in world famous. One room? the other side goyim with a joint chasid treif kitchen. No, so where do a boy and girl go? They're 19, they're 20, their hormones are acting up. What, they have to worry about God, about Torah, about halacha, about tarat mishpacha? So they get married. 3 years later, they get divorced. They're best of friends. I couldn't get over. There was one famous Russian refusenik. When he got out, he went to live in Haifa. Everyone asked me, why did this individual go to Haifa, such a Talmud Chacham? You taught him, he's this, he's that, the other thing. I said, he ran to Haifa because there are three women in Jerusalem who go by the name, I don't want to mention his name, Mrs. Goldstein. You follow? Each one boasts she was married to this guy for 2 years. So he went to Haifa with his latest wife, and he kept her. He hasn't divorced. He's here since the 80s, Baruch Hashem. Still married to him. Works for Shvatam. They're a terrific individual. But that was their society. So imagine a guy becomes a Baal Tshuva. He comes to Israel. Shvatam gets hold of him. Before you know it, he's wearing a black hat, only eating a Badatz Hepsha. And he was married. This is the fourth time. Forget about him. What about the women? They want to remarry. Mamzera, Jew, married Jew. Ah, it's not a marriage. There was no kavana. This is mamish the words of the Besamim Rosh. And it seems that kiven shalachat et chilal yom pelegesh vidari mazman rav adarabi harei chizik atzmo behipuch and his word is at matla. The amre yinish b'dedome dechazi didoyma b'yulepilek sholakha. Those words are so modern, as if they were written today. That it doesn't matter how many years he lived with her. His whole intent was a concubine. And she lived with him. Whatever. She was happy. She was satisfied. There are women who are the happiest people in the world, that they're concubines he provides for. Don't have to go into detail. Even today, Lo Aleinu, even in Baropak you find it. Even in Frumkum, there's a hope. Israel's a little bit better because we don't have the standard of living of America. I'm the Lamed Zchut in America, but when you have a standard of living, so God have mercy what men are capable of doing. Gentlemen, this is a fascinating tshuva of the Besamim Rosh. Am I reading too much into it? Could be, Yitzchak. Could be I am. But it's fabulous. It's as if it was written in Tchumim. As if it was written in Hapades. If it was written in one of the Torah journals that are issued today. And I need not tell you that you'll find this in the Moshe. You'll find tremendous opposition to this in the writings of Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. You'll find endless tshuvot of the Batei Dinim in Israel. Let me tell you, there was no other problem that was dealt with as much as this question, Labriyut, because of the Russian immigration. The Mamzeret problem is real, tangible, here, now. But this is the approach, Lahakel.
The option would be if a reformer or conservative rabbi...
That's Reb Moshe, the same story.
What is, how do we handle
Halacha l'maisa, if they can't get a get, they mutter the woman to remarry. In other words, lachatchila, you always try to get a get. Even with civil marriage, lachatchila, you try to get a get.
The Rosh would say it was as if it
was no marriage. The Besamim Rosh would say it's a pilegish. That's exactly it. Again, if you can quote him, again, I'm a little afraid to quote him, lahalacha, but he's a very strong advocate here, built upon the Tshuvat HaRosh. In other words, or Danny, you follow me? When you look at the Tshuvat HaRosh, the gist of it is there. This is a very exceptional example. Whoever's going to do a doctorate out of the Besamim Rosh, I want to call his or her attention to the fact that this is exceptional, because you find the exact tshuva in the Rosh. What's amazing here, Danny, is he elaborates a lot more, and in that elaboration is modernity. It's as if you're viewing the problem as the Achronim would deal with it in the 1800s, the 1900s. And I'm afraid in the 2000s as well. And it's unbelievable how ahead of his times he was. And this was part of his tragedy. If the Besamer Rosh were alive today, I think he would be one of the most famous Rosh Yeshiva in YU. And if you think that he had an axe to grind, so Chovevei Torah would take him, but Kavod Gadol. That's all I can say. Yeah, quickly, Nachum. Yeah.
Wasn't the whole argument that the Rav and Rav Rachman is that if the Gaon of Vilna makes a sociological statement, it doesn't change?
The Rav claimed that Tav Lemeitav Tandu Melemeitav Amalo was ontological. Again, that's a fancy word that the Rav taught me. Ontological means, Ephraim, part of creation. Okay? I'm sure Mendy can fill you in on the origins of the word, but I know it from the Rav, ontological, part of creation. So therefore the Rav claimed that that could never change. Rabbi Rachman claimed it was a sociological concept. And therefore, since a chazaka is based upon a social reality, it can change if the reality changes. And Rabbi Rachman's biggest proof was what we spoke about in class, that the Gemara says, Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatznut. And in the year 2012, no one in the world will say that. Because Lo Aleinu, we see every day wonderful frum Jews with all types of different headgear and all types of different looking faces, and they're engaged in Bilatznut. Because the Western world has taken away our antipathy, our recoil from such animal-like behavior. And believe me, people will listen to the Shia and say, Rakefet, what chutzpah, animal-like behavior, a natural biological instinct. You understand? This is the conflict. So I asked Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein that very question, that Rabbi Rachman has a strong point. It is, we see that certain chazakas, that the Achronim reinterpreted them, or abrogated them, or negated them, use whatever word you want. So Rabbi Aaron told me yes, but the Rav felt that Tav Lemeitav Tandu is not just the sociological chazaka, it's rooted in the very pasuk, El Baleich Teshukateich B'Huyim Shalbach. And what it means is, you speak of a spinster, an unhappy spinster. It's true. I have some women who didn't marry, and when they let their hair down, I've seen women who had every chance to marry. Oh, who needs a man? Who needs? They say to me, we made a mistake. A bachelor? The singing bachelor, the happy bachelor, the lucky bachelor. Oh, what goes on with bachelors? So then it seems to me that there is truth to it. This is what Rabbi Aaron told me in the name of the Rav. I didn't ask the Rav. I was living in Israel at the time. But Rabbi Aaron evidently had discussed it with the Rav. And this is what he quoted in the name of the Rav. Okay, but that machloket was a tremendous machloket. And ultimately, I don't have to tell you, that way of thinking and Rabbi Rachman and other incidents that happened ultimately give birth to the whole Chovevei Torah and Avi Weiss and everything that's happening, and Danny Sperber and everything that's happened today on the left of the Orthodox or the Torah world. It's a real problem. And I have to tell you, these people do not have bad intention. In other words, you don't say Rabbi Rachman had... Rabbi Rachman was a Yid Tzaddik. I knew Rabbi Rachman very well. He was one of the finest, nicest people you could meet. His midot tovot, his concern, a pastoral rabbi par excellence. I was chavruta with his son Michael, 51, 52, perhaps 53, 54. I was a ben bayit in his house in Far Rockaway. I mean, don't misunderstand, but his intentions, he wanted to solve these problems that burdened him. But then you come to the problem of Gevur Toshav, of the boundary, and what we can do and what we can't do. Now, seven Ishma. The whole problem of the Aguna today, it made the front page of the New York Times. I'll show it to you later, tomorrow, whatever. But there's a limit to what we can do. When Blue Greenberg said, when there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, that is absolute, total, complete Reform Judaism. The whole concept of surrender is missing. And that was thrown in my face all over the United States. A miyut, not a miyut hanika, but in halachic terminology, but a vociferous minority. And everyone quotes Blue Greenberg, and they really believe it. Boy, if we could change Judaism to fit us, we're driving to Shul Shabbos, we have Shabbos buses, where we can eat fish in a trafe restaurant. Wow, what we can do is beyond words. We can have a few wives, a few pilakshim. There's no end to it. But that's not Judaism. That's not Torah. That's not surrender. That's not Maaseh Nishma. Okay, but it's a problem. I'm not here to criticize the person, but I'm here to interact with the ideas. But let me go.
Marriage requires intent. If someone has a pilakish, that's no intent.
Right.
If a person actually goes.
Right. So you're saying that civil marriage is much harder.
That's already an intent.
You're absolutely right.
So yet,
you are in a good camp. You know who agrees with you? Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, Umarenu Barabeno Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Salavechi. So you, Rabbi Reuben, are in a good camp. And I spoke about this with the Rav at length. The Rav was maskim with me that perhaps we can permit the children to marry, because Mamzeret is only a lav. It's not a chiyuv mita. So for the woman to remarry, it's a chiyuv mita. It's eishadish, eishadish. The child is only a lav. Efshadotin can be mekel zayin. Okay? But the Rav absolutely agrees with you. That's his Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin.
Now, if a reform rabbi and a conservative rabbi.
It makes it even worse.
They served as intent.
It makes it even
worse. They're shocked to find out that we don't consider.
No, they know that we don't consider. They're not shocked. Everyone knows Rav Moshe today. Everyone knows. Everyone knows Rav Moshe. It's not a secret.
But the average person who gets married in a kibbutz, a reform rabbi, they never heard of Rav Moshe.
In England, they have to say.
I don't know about in a kibbutz. The kibbutz is. I'll tell you, kibbutz is less of a halachic problem, because there in general there's an idea we share everything, so they share their wives and share this.
No, that's not today.
And I hope you're, it's not today. I don't know, Haaretz is just as anti-religious and anti-Zionist today as it was 70, 80 years ago. It's amazing they're willing to lose tens of millions of dollars to uproot Israel and Torah, quote, end quote, from Haaretz. I'm not sure it's not today, but anyway. In England, you get married by a Reformed rabbi. There is a real problem. But the world today knows that the Orthodox do not, the Torah world does not consider it a proper condition, and therefore, b'di'evet, it doesn't count, you don't need to get.
What did that kid do?
The children are not mamzerim. Everyone paskins that way. Everyone is samach on Rav Moshe. It's not just Rav Moshe, there are many tshuva. But the biggest make here, we dealt with it on a daily basis, was Rav Moshe. But you take a hold, like Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu wrote two entire volumes against Rav Moshe. They lived two blocks from each other in FDR Drive in the East Side, and they fought bitterly over this topic.
How
and
was their relationship?
The best of friends. And the Rav came down on Rav Henkin's side, not Rav Moshe. But the Rav didn't make too much noise, because the Rav was not a posek. As Givena Malamed, you understand? That was the Rav's famous comment, which is absolutely right. The world calls Rav Moshe the Posek, the Rosh Yeshiva rather, and the world calls me the Rav. And he says they should call me the Rosh Yeshiva and Rav Moshe the Rav. Because what does the Rav have to do to Paskin Shilas? It's a good comment by the Rav. Okay, now we come back to a topic that has haunted us and that we spend so much time on with sideshows, and it's fascinating. The whole problem of shaving, cutting your hair. And here again, you have to understand, Jews evidently had beards in the ghetto. Jews evidently did not necessarily have beards at the time of the Talmud. We know that Moed Katan, the whole question of coming out of jail, coming out of Avelet, when you can cut your hair, when you can shave your beard. So you see that Jews did shave. I told you. I once read a book, a Talmud of mine, became very right-wing. It was my Talmud in the 60s. He published a whole book, 600-700 pages. I think it's gone through a new edition, against shaving with an electric shaver. I went through the safe. I came to the conclusion you can shave. But it's interesting, Hadrat Panim, but all right. But you see, we're influenced by our society. I let me give you a simple example. I was interviewed, you recall, by the Jewish press. Well, generally, I don't want to go for interviews. too many people know my name already. It's not good. That's why your website creates tremendous problems for yours truly. But okay, what can you do? It's Chabad Sata Torah, and you're part of a team, and you have to be part of the team. So the OU insisted that I be interviewed, you know, because my new book, Be'ezrat Hashem, the co-publisher or the main publisher is the OU. So create publicity for the book. So I'm interviewed. Now, do you remember what happens? They ask me why I don't wear a black hat. So I give an answer. So you remember this kid wrote in, remember I responded, generally I don't respond to criticism because everyone's entitled to their opinion. But when you hear idiocy, you have to respond, you know, if someone can't think right, 1 and 1 is 2, it's not 11. So he writes that I'd be one of those who wouldn't leave Egypt because I wouldn't know how to change my clothes, right? He quotes the Midrash. Just think who's writing this, a kid living in the Golah who doesn't speak Hebrew, writing to someone who came in Aliyah 42 years ago, served in the army, fought in 2 wars, has taught Torah Alat Mata Kodesh for 42 years already, etc., etc., etc. So Ribbono Shel Olam, you're telling me, and a black hat? You wear a black hat? Remember what I said, made in Italy, made in Hungary, where Jewish blood is on the ground? I wear a baseball hat, made in China. No recorded case of anti-Semitism in China. But okay, why did the kid say that? I don't want to mention his name, I remember the name, it left an impression. I responded in class. Not in print, let the kid be, let him think he knifed me. My pleasure that he should have nachat, that he slaughtered a Talmud of the Rebbe, a so-called centrist, I don't know, right of center, but it doesn't matter. So why did the kid write that? Because in his society, everyone has a black hat. And, you know, I spend about 5 weeks a year in Borough Park. I daven in a shtubel. I daven there for maybe 10, 15 years already. All right, I'm the only one in the shtubel without a black hat. There's black hat, shtreimel. I wear a kippah sprugash. I've sort of a big white kippah sprugash. Fine. They know me. It's not a problem for them. Baruch Hashem. But, you see, to their way of thinking, if everyone kisses it, sits it, and Moreno Verabenu, the Gadol Hadar, Gon Adir, Rabban Lichtenstein, doesn't kiss it, sits it, he can't be from, he can't be like, can't be anything, it's a big bluff. You understand? They, in their mind, it's like that. And we're all products of that way of thinking. In other words, there are people who think if you don't wear a kippah sprugah, you're not from today. All right, it has to do with the whole series, you don't serve in the army, you know, the whole question. I hear my grandchildren, and they're all, you know, all yeshiva boys, all has the boys, but I see the tension and their negative feelings towards the people who don't serve in the army, which, of course, they all know is a mitzvah d'oraita. It's mamash a milchemet mitzvah shein kedugmato, safe survival of the Jewish people. Rov binyan and binyan of Am Yisrael is living here. But you see, we're a product of society. So at the time that the Besamim Rosh came out of the ghetto, in the ghetto, everyone evidently had a beard. And suddenly you come out into the big world where intelligent, upright, sophisticated, underline the word sophisticated, muturbatim in modern Hebrew, sophisticatia, you know, but muturbatim in modern Hebrew. No one has a beard. And this enters the halakhic literature. By the end of the 1700s, the Nod of Yehuda, and afterwards a floodgate is opened. Are you allowed to shave?
What did Nod of Yehuda
say? Well, that's the famous tshuva, that he was matir on Cholomayed, a poel who doesn't have what to eat, who needs money for yontif, or a Jew, or a goy, efshikem in matir zayin. Now, obviously, shaving already is depends upon society. We shave every day. That's the story I told you with the rug, with Eric Zimmer, with Rabbi Dr. Professor Yitzhak Zimmer. I'm an ear witness where he asked Rebbe, it was before Pesach, he says, Rebbe, it's after class, right? When the Rebbe finished, he was exhausted, he was slumped in his chair. So the Nudniks, like me and a few others, we didn't leave him. The rest of the class ran out, they went to lunch, whatever, or the day that they had to go, but whatever. But a few of us stood around with Rebbe, and we would walk him, remember, walk him down the hallway and walk him across the street to his mother's apartment. So Eric says, Rebbe, can I shave on Chol HaMoed Pesach? The Rav says, what's the question? So Eric says, well, you know, Chol HaMoed, the Machloek is this, that. The Rav says, do you shave every day? Yes. Will you shave Erev Yontev? Yes. It's no Shailah. You're not Naveilut. What are you going to do, Chol HaMoed? He says, well, I want to go out with I have some dates lined up with some ladies. You want to go like a Slav? And the Rav, that was it. You can shave. All right, I'm going to tell you the Chubit of Rav Moshe, Rav Tzipas Safran. There's a world of material on this. Today, more or less, even the right-wing part of the Torah world, using proper popular language, understands that if a person shaves, he's not necessarily a shakes. I think it is a problem for them to understand the person shaving is a big Talmud Chacham. That perhaps is difficult for them. But we all understand that Moshe Shera shaved. Now, when Moshe Shera, who probably was the greatest Jewish Askan, how would you translate that into English? Political leader, how would you translate Nachum? Askan. He was, what would you call him?
Fixer.
A fixer? No. Give Rav Moshe Shera more credit than that. He was a fabulous individual. So when Rav Moshe Shera, I mean the dignity and the relationship with Congress, with the Senate, with the President, and just insight and his ability to keep away from Machloket, I mean, I know some of the inside stories, and I go to Israel of America, you have to stand in awe of an individual like Rav Moshe Shera. So when he would come to Israel, the papers here would go crazy, the Haredi press, how can there be the head of a Haredi Israel in America is clean-shaven. And that was one of the reasons he could never come in Aliyah. He would, they would eat his heart out here. But all right, they needed him in America. I can understand that. So shaving at the time that the Besamim Rosh is living is a tremendous controversy, because the Haredi world, using modern terminology, views shaving as assimilation. The Besamim Rosh views shaving as modernity. We're coming out of the ghetto. Quote Rakefet, the Rav saw a good at Yisrael in Poland, at a Sudashli Shis, at a Shalashuris, they ate herring with their fingers, right or wrong, ashtikel brei, you'd rub it into the sauce around the herring, pick up the herring, a tzibula, an onion. The Rav came to Berlin, he saw Agudat Yisrael when they sat down for Sudashli Shit, three different forks, one for the herring, one for the kugel, one for the dessert. Now, it doesn't mean you're a shagetz because you don't eat the herring with your fingers anymore. You understand me, David? Put yourself, understand what we're talking about. Now, when the Besamim Rosh is coming out of the ghetto, he feels we got to be modern. We have to be up to date. We have to shave. I can only tell you, we've come so far in living among the big world that a guy like Rakefid, I feel like a bum when I'm not shaving. You understand? It's psychological. But is that anti-Torah or is that fine? Okay, let you decide by the growth on your face. I can only tell you, two of my sons-in-laws have beards big enough that if you turn them over, you could sweep up the whole second floor of gross. You understand? So I'm not telling you, I've grandchildren ready with beards. I'm not telling you it's a hard Yava that you're not allowed to shave, but you have to feel the conflict within the human being. This was the Besamim Rosh. Now, the question here is amazing. His mind was so fertile, was so innovative that he could come up with questions. And again, there's a whole literature on this of Shelet and Shuvet that are real, not real, did it really happen, were they only made up, the Truma Tedeshin, there's someone did a doctorate on it, Shlomo Eidelberg. I don't know. Again, it's a fascinating topic. It's not for now. So here, the Summon Rosh Mem, 40. And here, he comes in, not just someone that shaved. He presents it differently. Someone who's very makpid to take a haircut very often. And Chol HaMoed, not only did he shave, but he took a haircut. Wow. Okay? And he quotes, this is the Rush, you know, he's quoting this as if the Rush is speaking, that the Rush quotes Rabbeinu Tam as being Matir. Okay? Okay? And they quote Rabbeinu Tam as being Mati. Now you all know the Rabbeinu Tam Heta that floats around is a totally different Heta. It has nothing to do with taking a haircut. It has to do with shaving. Why? Because the Rabbeinu Tam says if you shave every Yontif, then the whole reason perhaps for not being allowed to shave on Chol HaMoed falls away, and therefore you can shave on Chol HaMoed. That's what the Rabbeinu Tam says. Does he say it anywhere? We don't have a primary source. He's quoted in the Torah. There's no primary source. No one has seen the Rabbeinu Tam in Shas, in Tosfot, in the Sefer Yasha, actually saying it. But this concept floats around.
So if some of us can fake out the Rosh, he can fake out Rabbeinu Tam.
Well, of course, he's faking him out here, because he leaves you with the impression that Rabbeinu Tam was mati, not just shaving, but a haircut as well. And then he says, and he's putting these into the word of the Rush, but we don't paskin like the Rabbeinu Tam. Sharei Rabbeinu Meshulam, v'Rabbeinu Tuvya Mevina, v'chein Rabbeinu Meshpira Chokwala, v'kotz v'shoinim. I don't know whether these all exist. Rabbeinu Meshulam we've heard of, Rabbeinu Tuvya I never heard of. And Abar Macharehem, and they don't paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. They paskin like those who asar. Now, according to the Summon Rosh, what did they do to this Jew who took a haircut and shaved? They put him into cherem. Nidui. You all know what nidui means. When you're over a din derabbanan, you're in nidui. I just heard the Rav today talking about Yom Tov Sheni as a minhag, and it's brought down that you put someone into nidui for not observing Yom Tov Sheni, and the Rambam calls it a minhag. And the Rav was using that for a certain chiddush he wanted to develop in relation to Yom Tov Sheni. But anyway, be it as it may, he says, why'd you put him in chayim? He has Rabbeinu Tam. Yesh al mi l'smoch. Fine. We don't paskin that way. La techila, we wouldn't agree. But if he did it, how can you put him in cherem if he has Rabbeinu Tam? That is the Tshuva Tarash. It's all of about 11 lines long. On this Rush, we'll see next week, there's a long commentary of the Besamim Rosh called the Kasa Dehasana, and you'll see what he does with this Shaila, how he analyzes it, comes up with a fabulous insight, and you'll see he's describing the way two-thirds of this class lives in the year 2012. Now, what else has he accomplished? Once again, he pushes Rabbeinu Tam. Who is more important? Rabbeinu Meshulam? Rabbeinu Tuvya? Rabbeinu Mishpira, a name that's not even mentioned? Who heard of these people? You got to go to my classmate. Who am I talking about? Rabbi, Doctor, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. what do the boys call them? Dr. Grach. I mean, the students have such insight. If they describe you as a lamdin or a nitwit, you can be sure the students are right. That Chagdara, Dr. Grach, Dr. Gon, Reb Chaim, is perfect. You have to go to Reb Chaim. Maybe there was Rabbeinu Meshulam. Maybe there was Rabbeinu Tzofia. Rakevet didn't hear it then because he's an Amaretz. But one thing is for sure, all of us heard of Rabbeinu Tam, and the seeds of modernity are being sowed. Let me reiterate, and I have a lot to explain and give out. Tomorrow is a very important shiur. What can I tell you? Tomorrow I'm reaching the apex. Not the apex of the apex, but we're almost on top of the mountain tomorrow. What I have to say, it'll take me tomorrow, next week, maybe the week afterwards. And then Yitzchak will be very happy. I'm starting the long trek to Da'as Teira. Baruch HaTov Melech HaLam Shekhon Yibidro. And don't make a Shekhiyonu yet. I'll make one on my new book before you make a Shekhiyonu on Da'as Teira. Yitzchak, you have to have knowledge. It has to go slap slap. Boy, oh boy. Gentlemen, tomorrow is continuing what I did last week, how to relate to a Jew who's not observant. And I'm going to go into the mind of an unobservant Jew and show you the way he thinks. And then we're heading into Chovevei Torah and just a few words on the contemporary scene as viewed against the conservative background. Then I'm going in to the swing to the right, and then I'm going in to why Aaron Rakefet has every right to be furious. It's an understatement, ballistic with the right-wing world, and I'm going to give you many examples in class. And I will end off, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, what I just described is a nice few weeks of work, but for the sheer where I go crazy and show you why I have a right to be furious, it should really be a $99,000 shear, but because the Rebbe makes a jadrul out of himself, you don't even know what that word means, check with an Italian, it's on the house for nothing. Gentlemen, what did we do today? We answered some of the emails that I received. We spoke about the trip to America. I gave you the good story and the difficult story. And those two stories say it all. It's a great deal with setting those two stories. We went into the Besom and Rosh. We dealt with the nephew marrying his aunt. And then we started with, and we went into the whole Pilegish and the whole Matan discussion. Again, I don't know, am I reading into the Besom and Rosh? I don't think so. I think he knew just what he was saying, and he was facing a reality that was starting to develop outside the ghetto. We went in to the haircut, the shaving, we just scratched the surface. And I'm going to show you a lot more next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. And next week I'll also show you something that appeared in the Rabbinic Journal just a few weeks ago, dealing with something we're going to quote in class. It's amazing how the Besom and Rosh keeps on popping up. Now, this is from the New York Times. This case of the man who won't give a divorce appeared on the front page of the New York Times while I was in New York, and he's in Washington. I know the family, it's a Baltimore family, and his wife is an Aguna. What's interesting here, read it carefully, because you'll see that justice is not entirely on her side. His divorce settlement, the judge, throughout the fact he's Shomer Shabbos and he winds up only able to get the child Saturday when he can't take the child because he's Shomer Shabbos. He can't get the child before, you understand it?
They said that that's not really true.
Well, I don't know.
They didn't respond to that.
I hope it's not true, but when I read it, I said...
What does that have to do with giving a get?
So if you want to know what has to do with giving a get, you're missing what's going on in America right now, but it's not public knowledge, so let me not say it publicly until it becomes public knowledge. Then I'll comment on it. But what it has to do, that he feels in his mind until he gets a proper divorce settlement, which was equitable, underline the word equitable, he shouldn't give a get. And other men have told me the exact same thing. Anyway, this is the article. I don't say I side with him, but I say it's very fascinating. Gentlemen, the world is shaking over the what creates death. You're all aware of what's going on.
Well, who gave Rav Heschel to be Machlok?
The world is shaking.
Rabbi
Schachter is entitled. You're entitled to your opinion.
I'm not a goal.
He's entitled to his opinion. Rabbi Willick agrees with him. The chief rabbinate of England agrees with him. Gentlemen, the world is shaking.
This is not a heavyweight.
For your edification. Yitzchak, you're being recorded. The whole world knows, and when you, the chief rabbi of England may very well listen to the Shia, and he's going to come after you. So behave yourself, boys. You have to protect. You have to protect Rabbi Reuben. He's too loose. I learned. I said something in 1999, when I never dreamt it would be on a website. So I said something about a man, totally complimentary. His grandson, some idiot, listened and told the grandson, you know, like a caliph. What's the word in Chazam? Shaset a caliph. What the rabbi said about your grandfather? Wow, I got an email. Lashon hara? What? Lashon hara? The grandfather, tzaddik yisrael olam, the price he paid, what he told me, I repeat it. So you got to be very careful. Today, if I would tell the sense, I wouldn't mention a name. I'd have to mention a name. All right, kid. Some idiot misinterprets it and gets the grandson all riled up. His father's not riled up. I go, God, what did I say? I wrote out a letter. I told Sherry, email him. I said, how can I say something negative about your grandfather? I'm 100% positive. I never had a closer friend than your grandfather. Anyway, be it as it may. Gentlemen, the world is shaking. So I want to tell you the following. Tomorrow night in Chovevei Tzion, I have the right name of the shul, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler is speaking on the topic. There will be fireworks. I have in front of me the failed Messiah from, this is the letter against the RCA position. And all the rabbis who signed on, among them many graduates of the Kollel. This, I can't give away, I have to hold on to it for a while, but this is correspondence from Rav Moshe Shera to Rabbi Tendler, 1991, on this topic. And what did Rav Moshe say? And let me tell you, it burns your hand off when you read it. What's my own opinion? I have no opinion. I don't understand it. I'm not a medical doctor. I have to admit, if David were alive, if David Applebaum were alive, I would ask David, I say, David, what's my opinion? Whatever he would tell me would be my opinion. I did speak with a doctor this morning. One thing I can tell you, that you can go with brain death if you do it the way the chief rabbinate announced it, to do certain tests. And the problem is that in America these tests are not done. In other words, they're too busy. The hospitals are too busy. They're going to do a test. The guy is dead anyway. Take out 10 minutes. Do the test. Here, it could be that Rabbi Tendler is right. But to see that the brain is totally not working. What's it called? Whatever. To see that the brain is totally not working. Gentlemen, if anyone's interested, this is all on Lubavitch teaching at YU with all the pictures, and the Chabadnikim assure me they come from the Ohelei Torah Yeshiva. They come as volunteers to teach. Let's get a few things straight. The YU students pick out the Svarim. They pick out what they want to learn. No one is forcing them to learn. The fellows from Ohelei Torah and the YU people enjoy each other. And believe me, I am totally in favor. Why not broaden your own learning, your own perspective? And what are some learn Gemara, some learn Tanya? You're not beside them, but it's a Chabadnik. You're getting someone from a different yeshiva. You're getting a different impression. Let him sneak in what he wants. So why you fellows should have enough seichel to know what he takes in. And what's wrong if he becomes a Chabadnik? What's so terrible?
Do you believe it's a
Shachar? After the Holocaust, yes. I believe that the Baal Tanya was right. My shaila is on the goyim who saved Jews. They had neshamas. And you know where they got their neshamas? Because they were special goyim who had Maimer HaSinai. I have no problem after the Holocaust accepting the Baal Tanya. Lehetach, my question is on the tzaddikim, on simple sugihara, on these goyim that saved Torah. What a debt of gratitude we owe to them. And you read the postdoctoral research out of Boston on simple sugihara. Why did he do it? And Levine goes through his first life and his second life. He read this one and that one. Thousands of footnotes. And at the end, he reaches one conclusion. He did it because how could he face his God if he wouldn't save innocent people? My yarmulke stands at attention to such goyim. I have no problem with the Baal Tanya. Okay, but this is fascinating if anyone's interested. Finally, the latest issue of Jewish Action that I will quote tomorrow in class or next week in class, it's Mesorah, it has Rabbi Heschel Shechter's article, other articles, and my own feeling is this came out now because of all the controversy with Chovev Torah and Rabbi Avi Weiss, it's stressing the Mesorah. My dear students, until we meet again, health and happiness, thank you so much for coming and filling the room. Das Vedanya. And we have one student about to join the IDF. And we salute him. Ani Mastia, Ivrit Yudu Beret.